now. The church where I am now is called Trinity Lutheran Church. There's about five of them in Manhattan, so it is a fascinating beginning. It was not begun out of any sense of the mission of the church. It was begun because of the self-interest of a real estate developer. I'm going to read from Pastor Saunders' History of Trinity Lutheran Church in 1944. He wrote it, one of my predecessors. There is no clear record on the subject, but tradition has it that the first steps were taken by a builder, Mr. Russell, who had built a number of houses in the Bloomingdale area, which is what the area was called, and who wanted a German church located there to attract thrifty German residents to occupy his buildings. So the founding of the church was to attract thrifty people to occupy the builder's buildings. So he had to find a pastor. Then one day, so the story goes, he picked up a man who had just been thrown out of a saloon. Upon inquiry, this unfortunate individual turned out to be a freelance Lutheran clergyman, full of the wrong spirit. The idea began to stir in the builder's mind. Here was his chance. He is then supposed to have straightened out the clergyman, which is in quotes every time, put him into contact with a group of sincere Lutherans and convinced them to move to the neighborhood to start this church. So the church started out with the self-interest of the developer. I have to say that now it's just the opposite, where the self-interest of the developer and the church are completely at odds with each other. But it's an interesting beginning. It began in 1888. Was it 1888? It began in a grocery store. And in fact, that's also interesting. They had to leave the grocery store and they found a different space to rent. It was located near a firehouse, and there's still a firehouse across the street. And because the horses there attracted flies to the neighborhood, merchants such as butchers, grocers, and bakers would not rent the place. For this reason, we were able to get the store for the church at a small rental of $48 a month. The first building of the church was in 1890, and then a larger building was built on the site, which is the church that's there now, in 1908. Now, Robert Moses, here he comes again. The first slum clearance project, and I did not know this until I came to this church, was in the neighborhood where I am now. And in 1949, he gave the church there a notice that it was going to be demolished. He demolished everything in 37 acres in that area of Manhattan as part of his slum clearance project, the first one. And the only building left standing in 1949 in those 37 acres is Trinity, which was built in 1908. The people, there is kind of the apocryphal story of the old German women who stood on the steps of the church and wouldn't let, you know, the bulldozers knock it down. And then there's the story of the pastor knowing somebody, and working out some deal to save the church.
Where in Manhattan
are you? I'm on West 100th Street between Amsterdam Avenue and Columbus Avenue. So actually, with this slum clearance project, though, the first thing, and this has affected the life of the church ever since, Robert Moses built, at that time, what was the largest public housing project in New York City, the Frederick Douglass Houses, 19 22-story buildings, these tall, right across the street from the church. Some of the people who had been displaced, and those were mostly populated by African Americans and some Puerto Ricans. People complained lower income because it was public housing. There was now no middle class housing in the neighborhood. And so across the street on the other side of the church was built middle income, but also high-rise apartments. So the church sits in the middle of thousands of housing units with a large public housing project on one side and condos and co-ops on the other side, divided by 100th Street. And although people are living face-to-face across the street, all the divisions are there. There's racial division, class division. On one side of the street, there's doormen, there's nice lobbies, there's balcony terraces where people can go out and get some, after being here, I guess I wouldn't call it fresh air, but but whatever, what qualifies for fresh air in New York. Clean elevators that work. On the other side of the street, there are none of those perks. Again, there's high levels of asthma. This is something we're actually working on in a community organizing group. But the ventilation system in the projects hasn't been cleaned since they were built. And this is, so one side of the street is children are very sick, not on the other side. There's another group. The area is also have recently been called Little Mexico. And I wondered before I came there, where do all the undocumented Mexicans live? Because I'm thinking they can't live in public housing being undocumented. They can't afford any of the other housing. They live in scattered apartment buildings, in some cases in nice middle-class apartment buildings, in the basements, very, very unsafe. It's kind of like a landlord has carved out a little extra bonus rental income for himself in the basement with no exit up a very narrow, flight of stairs that's only meant for boiler maintenance, not for families that are carrying children, groceries, laundry, strollers. And then they're a half a block from the church, and there's numbers of these buildings, but this is a half a block from us. There is about a 11-story building that is single room occupancy. On two floors are tourists and students, mostly students from Europe and Israel, that one student rents a room for a month or a few weeks or a few months, and it's fine for a single person in their 20s has one room and shares a bathroom on the hallway. The rest of the building in rooms that are, they only have room for at the most two beds and one dresser. There's just no space. I mean, they're tiny, they're cubicles. There's no bathroom, there's no kitchen, and there's families of up to 5 to 6 people living in these spaces. Maybe 50, 60, 70 or more people sharing a bathroom in the hallway. And then these are the people that, it's like the slave quarters. These are the people that keep the restaurant industry growing, take care of people's children, clean people's houses. The people in our neighborhood, they go to different grocery stores, their children go to different schools, there are different levels of medical care. People are all living in the same zip code, but are complete strangers. And I mean, I think this is probably true in many places, but it's so massive and intense in that particular neighborhood. And now recently, there is a new development. Several blocks from the church, Aerial Towers is going up. Aerial Towers is on Broadway, which is one more block from us. We saw pictures of these boxes that were, I counted, in the ones that we saw pictures of were about 15 stories. These buildings that are going up are going to be 37 stories. And nothing else around it is more than 10 stories. So everything is 10 stories, and these are going to be these two huge monstrosities, 37 stories. Upper West Side living like never before. Aerial East and Aerial West bring a new dimension of design and lifestyle to the Upper West Side. Classic 2 to 5 bedroom residences offering an astounding array of family amenities, including a pet spa. When asked one of the developers, they said, we are building some affordable housing as part of this. There are some units that begin as low as 1.2 million. The And what has really outraged people in the neighborhood is that these buildings are only going up because of the church, a church that did not consider the built environment an ethical concern. And their members told me as such. This comes to the issue of air rights. What air rights are in New York City, let's say you're only allowed to build 20 stories high. But the church, let's say, didn't build 20 stories high. So they have this much air over them that they could build, but they didn't. They can sell that air to an adjacent property so that the adjacent property can build the 20 stories and add on the 17 more stories that the church didn't use, and then the church can't use it themselves. And normally air rights are in the vicinity of 60% of the actual land values, but one church, not this one I'm talking about, but on a prime spot, just this was a record, sold their air rights for $430 a square foot, which was a total of $30 million for air. So this church, however, which is right near us, sold their air rights, and it was not a church that was hurting for money, which makes this worse, sold their air rights to this developer, which is the only reason it can go that high, with no conversation with anybody. And when I was giving a talk at our church for a neighborhood event, and there were six people from this church there, which I didn't know they were there. And when someone asked me about air rights, I said that I thought it was highly unethical because they were asking us if we were going to sell air rights, because now we have something going up next to us. And I said, you know, I thought it was very unethical for a church, although we have the legal right to make a decision like that, we don't have the ethical right to make that kind of decision that's going to have an impact on so much of a larger group of people with no conversation with them. The people from this church that had been involved in this came up to me afterwards. I thought, oh my goodness. I mean, I didn't regret what I said, but. And what they said to me was, that was so interesting. They said, we never thought of it as an ethical issue at all. Nobody ever brought that up to us. So the anger has, you know, been increased. One is the history of the developers, their complete disengagement from the neighborhood in which they're building, their consistent refusal to meet with community leaders. They tried to rush the demolition. They tried to rush a lot of things to avoid community organizing against them. And as part of that, there was a collapse that trapped and almost killed a baby in a stroller, and it collapsed on top of a baby in a stroller that was being pushed by, who fortunately was okay. And then, of course, the church and you know, people also thought that perhaps the church, because of having this valuable air, could have negotiated perhaps with the developers to get some things that the community would have wanted, to include some lower income housing or other kinds of give backs that would benefit the well-being of people being pushed out because of this kind of housing market. But none of that happened. We have a group now of congregations that include Christians, Jews, a mosque, and some Buddhists who have come together to organize around a number of issues in the neighborhood, and one of them is housing. And in some ways, the development is going at such a breakneck speed, but you know, we still have the hope of our faith traditions to try and do something. And one of the issues, like in the South Bronx, is the issue of power and voice, the sense that the community should have a say in these kinds of decisions that have serious impact on the community. And as in the Bronx, you know, in our situations anyway, the voice is not going to be given to us. The developers are not going to call up, or like this architect that went and lived somewhere. No, they're not going to call up and say, how can we work together? We really have to take initiative and find our common ground, not let our differences get in the way, so that all these changes do not undo what have been some of the best part of the character of the community that's taken years to grow. We're working on a statement. It's in terms of development. It's called Towards a Theological Statement of Principles Regarding Development and Community. And that's why I was so interested, I mean, in this conference, and I shared with them Tim's book. I won't read the whole statement, and actually, we're still working on it, and there's some parts of it I'm not happy with. But I'd like to share some of it. As members of the faith communities of the Upper West Side, we have committed ourselves to working together on issues of peace and justice in our community. Among those issues currently facing us, one of the most critical is our understanding of the role of development as it relates to our houses of worship and to our broader community. We are called to be witnesses both within and to the broader community. We are reminded that in scriptures, the word house ultimately refers to a people, not a building. Thus, when we seek to build, we are called on to create and therefore be partners with God in the ongoing work of creation. Our building must be in the spirit of aesthetics and ethics. Beauty and justice must walk hand in hand. We must create houses of worship and buildings that are centers of community, in the center of and for community. We must respect and retain the spiritual and aesthetic heritage of our communities, while at the same time pointing towards a future that better represents our vision of the beloved community and serves as a beacon for the broader community. It is in this spirit that we offer these principles. 1, foster economic and racial diversity within the community. 2, avoid, prevent displacement of existing neighborhood residents. 3, create new affordable housing, especially housing affordable to residents of moderate and low incomes. 4, preserve neighborhood institutions, including cultural and religious institutions and other nonprofit institutions that serve the needs of our diverse community. 5, preserve historic or notable buildings that are part of the community's shared physical heritage and respect the existing built context of the community. That's something that we're working on as a kind of ethics of our built environment. Now, the congregation I serve has a developer right next door. At the first anyone heard of this, nobody in the community knew anything about it until all the businesses for 3 blocks down Amsterdam and for 3 blocks down Columbus, our church is between them, were all given eviction notices. A hardware store that next to the church that had been there for 40 years, provided jobs that supported 23 families, was just an anchor of the community. Grocery store that served thousands of low-income residents, in contrast to the more expensive gourmet chains, it was the only kind of lower-income chain. A block-long discount store that was patronized by people from all different economic levels, but was absolutely relied on by the poor, who have no other discount store locally available. All of the businesses were evacuated, were evicted. The notice came last fall. They're all closed now. And within the next 5 months, they're all going to be demolished. And what's going to go up is some more of these things. For our church, there's a twofold threat. There's the threat to the whole neighborhood. Then we have a physical threat, like many old urban buildings, church buildings. Our church is not in good shape. We do not have the money to keep it up. The sanctuary is stunningly beautiful, largely due to these windows it has. But to make a long story short, it needs a new roof, it needs pointing, it needs new wiring. It probably needs $2 million worth of work. We haven't even been able to raise enough money for an engineering study that we need. We have a pro bono lawyer. The developer will be responsible for damage, but that's after the fact. So it raises a lot of questions. The foundation, fortunately, is very good. You know, should we tear it down? Should we sell it for, probably about $8 million we could get for the property. Should we sell it to a developer and say, build another box and give us a few floors for the church? Now, I'm not interested in presiding over that. But you know, we need to find allies, but it's very difficult. It's very difficult. I don't know what's going to happen. The spiritual presence, it seems to me that as a church, how we use our voice and our public partnerships in terms of the shape of the whole neighborhood, but also how do we use the space that we do have? And I think we have two obligations. The first is that in the space that we do have, the building we presently have, that we have to give preference in whatever decisions we make about its use and its future to those who are being most marginalized in our built environment there, that those who are on the margins elsewhere have to be at the center of that holy space, or it will cease to be a holy space. And that we must bear witness also by resisting the kind of segregation and divisions that are prevalent around us, and seek to be a place of reconciliation and strive to be a model of a different kind of community. So I'll just quickly say a little bit about those things. Kind of the mix in our congregation, Gabriela is a woman from Mexico. One day, a woman whose grocery she was packing asked her if she would come for a day to do housework, and she was really pleased that, you know, she was gonna get money to buy some things for her children. It was kind of heavy duty, cleaning floors and windows and walls all day. For 10 hours she worked, and when it was time to collect her wages, she was given a $10 bill and told that as a stinking Mexican, she shouldn't be there anyway, and shown the door. Another one of our members, Lilia, showed me a scar on her thigh and that she got from crossing the border. And she said that in Mexico, partly due to our own policies, in terms of the economy there, she could earn 250 pesos a week, and that diapers cost 70 and shampoo cost 30. And she said you could wash or you could eat. So she came with her children through the barbed wire fence and, you know, got her scars. Lilia and Gabriela are both now on our church council. And they're part of our growing ministry with Mexican immigrants. Last Thursday, our bishop came to bless a center that they founded called Amigos en Pie. It's a center of resources where for immigrants, we can't offer, you know, every single service a person might need, but we're connected to lots of different other organizations, and that the people have researched, and then people come and they help them find this kind of help, and it's been a really wonderful thing for the immigrants themselves to be doing this and having this space. And so it's required rearranging our space in the church to make an office for Amigos en Pie. It requires a mental space. If we have people that only speak Spanish in our church council, we have to make time for translation. We have to do things differently. Another issue is if you live in a cubicle, how can you have a family gathering? Mm-hmm. Unless you can go outside and have it, but which you can't do if it's bad weather at night, which you can't have a party, you can't celebrate a birthday. And so our church hall has become that place for a lot of these families that have no other social gathering place available. We also have a program for people who are HIV positive. And a new thing that we're just going to be voting on soon, there is another a growing group in our city that has no space. And those are homeless gay, lesbian, and transgender youth. Because as there's some more openness culturally in different ways, more young people are coming out to their families at a younger age and are being kicked out. And a lot of them come to New York thinking, well, New York, you know, is liberal and open, and I'll get a job and I'll get housing. Of course, this is where things break down, getting a job and being able to afford housing. And there is no shelter. There's one shelter in all of New York City for these youth with 12 beds. They're not welcome in regular shelters. And last winter, there were there was a call that went out to churches because the one place with a shelter was turning away 50 young people a night in, you know, sub-freezing temperatures. And they asked for different churches to do it for a week. And we ended up doing it for 3 weeks, and now we're voting on whether we're going to do it 365 days a year. And it's a difficult thing, because it's one thing to do it for 3 weeks, but it also it raises a lot of space questions, like, well, the shelter is from 9 to 9, and what happens if we have a church activity that goes beyond 9, or how are we going to have the Mexican parties? And but it's really through connecting with others. Other churches have said, you know, we can't do this 365 days a year, but if the Mexicans are going to have a party that night, or your youth group is going to have a lock-in, you know, we can open for that night. It's not the kind of issue that was, like, number one on the plate for Mexicans from small villages, but, and this is the reconciliation aspect. The first week we opened this winter, the young people came and sat down to a warm meal. It was arroz con pollo, enchiladas, and sopa de pollo, cooked by these Mexican mothers who know what it feels like not to know if you're going to find a place to live and if you're going to be welcomed or not. And when we had when we marched, you know, with one of these recent immigration marches, some of our gay members were, you know, marching with the immigrants. So it becomes a place for people to connect that wouldn't normally connect. We have most of our members are our church is about a third African American, a third white, and a third Mexican, and of all different classes. But not many. Only one couple that's really very wealthy, and one of the issues that came out among some of the undocumented women was gynecological care, that they can't get gynecological care. And one of these other members who learned about it has a lot of friends who were doctors. And then we also have a young woman who's a medical resident, who's a doctor. And they lined up 15 gynecologists who are each willing to take on two women as pro bono patients. I mean, on the one hand, it's a drop in the bucket, but it's a way of people helping one another in community. We find that we have to be very intentional about it, because especially people that don't speak the same language, how can they get to know each other? And we have worship in English and worship in Spanish. About every 5 weeks, we worship together bilingually. But we also set up one-on-ones. Well, we have, like, someone who speaks only English and someone who speaks only Spanish, and then we've got 10 to 12 people who are bilingual, so we'll pick one of those people, and then the three people can meet and around a certain topic and talk to one another and get to know one another, and it helps to build up those relationships. I don't have a PowerPoint thing, but anyone that's interested can look at this. This was a mural that was, I actually kind of envisioned something like this when I wrote my book, and then somebody I was talking to about it painted it. It's got Martin Luther, Our Lady of Guadalupe, and Frederick Douglass. The church is over here, and this is one of the Frederick Douglass projects, and it's got a rainbow, and the church, it looks like it's in the middle of a garden, and in fact it's not. 100th Street is not a garden, but and it's got a mountain, and that's from the Guadalupe story, but it's also, we have a little garden behind the church, and it's a connection between the city and the country, and the history of our immigrants from different places in the country, and farms, and all of them are figures of liberation in different ways. So that's kind of a vision of part, you know, the community we try to live out. And I'm going to end with the end of the poem by T.S. Eliot. Where the bricks are fallen, we will build with new stone. Where the beams are rotten, we will build with new timbers. Where the word is unspoken, we will build with new speech. There is work together, a church for all and a job for each. What life have you if you have not life together? There is not life that is not in community, and no community not lived in praise of God.
Right. That's a theme I've heard through your comments is the struggles you've had with the powers that be around you are often connected with their absence of any kind of relationship or contact or dialogue.
Yes.
And you can name that as present in racism or militarism or consumerism, but you were particularly naming it connected to the kind of housing industrial complex. Not that the development isn't needed, not that housing isn't needed, but there's an absence of community in reference to the final poem. There's an absence of community and process in deciding who builds where to live.
Uh-huh.
And from your experience, what is the role of the church in demanding that kind of
thing? Absolutely. We might not get it, but we must demand it. And we're in Manhattan. It's taken me, a while to kind of get my bearings there. I feel, and there is not as strong a community organizing as there. There's much more factions and all different political groups. So I feel like just now in this one group, people are starting to come together. It's not too late for everything. Oh, Frances, one woman I recently met who is part of a group that has successfully bought some buildings for people with different mental disabilities, but that's been through government money. But she's interested in working with the church to buy the building that where these people are living in cubicles, and she even knows a building where the people presently living there can move into and have it renovated into apartments, not for any of the tourists. But so that's hopeful in terms of work, maybe one building. And we are working to meet with the developers. The developers, if that hasn't been so successful, I think the one developer of this building said, you don't know how much I paid for this land, and I'm going to get as much out of it as I can. It's basically his. But there are people. We're working in terms of some zoning issues with the city. There are city officials that are much more open to some of these concerns than some of the developers themselves. And some developers are open to trying to be helpful. There's a developer in Brooklyn that might give us a roof. But I think, the church should be at the forefront. No one else is gonna do it.
Other questions or comments?
So, Roy has a follow-up, and then it sounds like a
very brief follow-up. As you were speaking, I was always getting a sense of the symmetry of alienation that's a part of what happens. There's a reference made to the extreme wealthy who have five houses that really don't live anywhere. They're probably the people on the other side of the development dynamic, which they themselves are alienated, and the people living in the very place where they build are have a sense of alienation.
Oh,
so there's a symmetry in the alienation.
Absolutely. And I, our daughter went for a while. She chose to go to this high school. She's in college now, but she got a scholarship to go to a very elite girls' high school with a lot of very wealthy girls. It was horrible for her, and she had a breakdown, but which wasn't necessarily entirely the fault of the school. But what shocked me, just because I hadn't for a long time been around very wealthy people, was the neglect. People, have this stereotype of a parental neglect. They did in the South Bronx, and drug abuse. The parental neglect and drug abuse among the very rich. It was absolutely that the alienation was absolutely parallel. And the very rich had, all these servants and. My daughter, because she's in early childhood education, though, babysits to make money. And I mean, she babysat for this one family. They had three different babysitters. You know, one for each child, full time. And the mother didn't work outside the home. And I mean, so, you know, that's just as alienating as the mother who's a single parent who can't be home because she's, you know, working. The transformation, I mean, it's unhealthy for everybody. The current system is unhealthy for everybody.
We have Britt and then Rhonda, and that will have to be it for the session.
It just sounds like, in the Bronx you started a development company. And it sounds like you're doing some of the, like, thinking to do that again. Am I?
Well, in the Bronx it seemed like now to me, but, you know, it certainly didn't seem easy then.
Right.
Now it seemed like so much easier. I mean, $3 million in the Bronx, you could do something.
Right.
I mean, $3 million in Manhattan, you know, you could buy a studio.
Right.
I mean, in the Bronx, the city at that point was giving land away.
Right.
They're not giving land away in Manhattan. So it seems, no, I mean, I don't have any vision of starting a development company, but that I feel like connecting with other people, there's hope to have some impact on some of the development.
And is scarcity the main reason that you would not think about doing that? I mean, that's what it's happening. I don't mean that. That's just kind of what I heard you say.
I don't feel like that's my. I don't feel like it's my calling to start a development company.
And I mean that. I don't mean that. That came out more sharp than I meant it.
No, I don't mean it sharp. I feel like the church needs to try and be creative in finding as many allies as possible, not necessarily all within the church at all,
right, sure.
To impact the development,
right.
to humanize the kind of development that's going on. That I definitely feel called to do.
And is there no inclusionary zoning at all in Manhattan?
There is some inclusionary zoning, but most of the inclusionary zoning is only for a certain amount of years, and now that's kind of becoming a problem because then those people can all be put out. And but it's an issue that is an issue people are working on.
This is the final question, Rhonda, please.
Final question. Very quickly, I did, as you're talking about churches being at the forefront of the call for justice, I did want to mention people who weren't aware. We do have a congregation based community organization that's been formed in Charlottesville. We've got an orientation tomorrow night, so after you're done here, you can head on over to Incarnation if you'd like. But I wanted to ask, because something some of us in this room have encountered that have been involved with the impact of this community organization, is resistance within our congregation, either from people who think that this work is irrelevant, this is not what the church is about, this isn't what the gospel is about, or what's more disturbing for me personally, people in the pews who are part of the system that benefits or are connected to people who are the decision makers who are putting up those developments and taking airspace. Have you had concerns with that at all?
I've been within the larger church, yes. I've been into both of the churches. I've only been at two in almost 25 years, so, and they're not usual. I mean, in the South Bronx, nobody in the congregation was benefiting from the status quo. I mean, there was some economic diversity within the congregation, but nobody was benefiting from it. So, I mean, there was just no question. People totally saw this connected to the, it was good news. There wasn't any, you know, the first being last and the last being first was good news. My present congregation is, liberal with a cap. I mean, you know, somebody, one member of our council once raised the question, you know, would a Republican feel welcome here? I mean, it's, you know, and that as a problem. I mean, and, you know, we thought about that. It's just an extremely, now that doesn't mean myself, I benefit from racism, classes. I mean, that doesn't mean that we're not enmeshed in the system. But in terms of, there's nobody, I know, and there's nobody in the congregation that I mean, our you know, when our ma- I mean, our major all ministries are in terms of, you know, gay, lesbian, and transgender teenagers, undocumented Mexicans, people with AIDS. It's a very, it's not, there's nobody that that raises those kinds of issues within the church, which is actually, you know, bad in the sense, I mean, it's not bad, but it's you can not realize how difficult it can be in some other context.
So there's no one that's like buddy-buddy with the developers or is sitting on the boards of organizations that are in favor of this?
We have one person that who's wealthy who has some of these kinds of contacts, but he actually was diagnosed with AIDS and was supposed to die, and then he didn't die, and so now he's kind of like feels like he's been given a second chance, and he wants to use all of his contacts to try and help. So that own sense of his vulnerability helped him to connect with the vulnerability of other people in a positive way. Mm-hmm. And I realize that's not the norm, but that's, well, whatever, that's my context.
Thank you, Heidi. So